Chapter 5. And so, in late September 1958, I arrived back at St. Peter's School to take up my first job. It was immensely comforting to find that everything felt so familiar. The grounds, the main buildings, the trees, the school dogs, and above all, the friendly, beaming face of Mr. Tolson. He still exuded an air of easy authority, even though he seemed a lot smaller than he had been when I was a boy. I always liked and trusted him, and it was reassuring to realize he was no longer allowed to cane me. I suddenly felt so much at home that my transition from pupil to teacher now seemed like a routine promotion. In addition, I had a priceless advantage in my new role, because a mere 2 months had elapsed since I'd ceased to be a schoolboy, and I therefore had an absolutely clear-sighted perception of the realpolitik of my situation. I did not need to consult Che Guevara or Ho Chi Minh or Lao Tzu to know that all new teachers are subjected to guerrilla warfare, and that if they did not stamp their authority from the start, they are goners, as they say in the teaching trade. I vividly now recall, 60 years after the event, what one particular Clifton class perpetrated on a sweet-natured but naive chemistry teacher called Baines. The poor creature only lasted 3 weeks before a nervous collapse saved him from further punishment. I can still visualize him being driven away in an unmarked van to the sound of cheers. So I knew that the next few days were not for the squeamish. I expected no quarter, but I was up for the fight, and I had chosen my weapon, the Black Mark. The St. Peter's Black Mark was purely metaphorical. It could be awarded to any boy who was guilty of a breach of discipline. To impose it, the teacher need only inform the boy, listen for a few seconds to his complaint, "Ooh, sir, it's not fair, sir, I thought I saw a warthog, sir." Confirm his crime, and then go to the staff common room and write down the boy's name plus a brief description of his offence, talking when on silence, fighting, impertinence, arson, and so forth. Now, to those of you who might scoff at the potential effectiveness of black marks in, for example, checking the surge in the number of armed robberies in South London, I have this to say. It was very effective at St. Peter's in 1958. Every Saturday morning at school assembly after prayers, Mr. Tolson would announce the names of all the boys who'd received black marks that week, and believe it or not, those boys were definitely discomforted. So, I ask you to imagine the effect on the whole school when on the first Saturday of term, Mr. Tolson began reading out the details of 16 black marks, and 12 of them turned out to have been awarded by this parvenu apprentice called Cleese. The boys, who had started assembly by eyeing me as their legitimate prey, now registered first surprise, then disbelief, and finally a growing watchful apprehension, as they had it brought home to them that this particular newcomer was not going to be taken alive. I sat there pretending this sort of thing happened to me every Saturday morning, and trying to conceal the wave of smug satisfaction that was passing through me, very similar to the one Himmler must have experienced just after the successful completion of the Night of the Long Knives. Even some of the other teachers seemed rather impressed. Now, I know that some of my listeners will suspect that I'm exaggerating the warlike nature of the relationship between schoolmaster and pupils. I accept that there are two major differences. The first, of course, is in armaments. The second is that in most wars, both sides want to win. In schoolroom wars, however, both sides want the teacher to win, because when he or she has, life can settle into a predictable pattern, allowing everyone to relax. I came to this realization because I was puzzled by the blatant unpopularity of one of the other masters, a young chap who seemed to be rather an amiable fellow. He left after a single term, and so I was able to seek guidance from one of the forms that he used to take. They were completely clear about what their reason was for detesting him. "You never knew where you were with him, sir," they said. "One day he was really strict, and the next day we could do what we liked, and then suddenly he'd get really angry." To my surprise, they were telling me exactly what they wanted from me. Consistency. It was fine to be strict like Captain Lancaster. He was always strict. Nevertheless, all the boys were very fond of him. It was also fine to be easygoing if you were always like that. But if the teacher imposed one set of rules one day and another set the next, the boys hated it, and him. There was only one drawback to my black mark strategy. I had to wait until the first Saturday for the full force of the headmaster's authority to be stamped on my decisions. Meanwhile, I learned that the first lesson in how to keep order is learn the pupils' names. Otherwise, me. So basically, the king had to keep order without having either police... stop talking. Boy. Me, sir? No, not you. You. I wasn't talking, sir. I'm not talking to you. I wasn't talking either, sir. I'm not talking to you either. I'm talking to you. What, sir? What do you mean, what, sir? Sorry, sir, what's the question? The question is, why are you talking? I'm not, sir. No, not you. Him. So your control of the class seeps away like guava juice through a semi-permeable membrane. No, the first thing you do is to get a piece of paper, do a rough sketch where the desks are, and then ask each boy for his name, writing it down in the right place. The second is, never tell a boy, stop talking, because he will always claim he wasn't. You must say, don't talk. Then, when he denies that he was talking, you can say, I didn't say you were, I said don't. This leaves him with nowhere to go. The third rule is, when you ask a question, always formulate it in full before you give the name of the boy who is to answer it, because if you start with his name, everyone else will immediately go to sleep. The fourth thing is, if you catch a whiff of impending insurrection, use sarcasm. They just can't handle it. It's wonderful. It's like shooting fish in a barrel or making fun of Donald Trump. It's so easy, it's embarrassing. But don't overuse it. Keep it for that special occasion. I began my career as a schoolmaster with one considerable disadvantage. As I had confessed to Mr. Tolson, I knew nothing about the subjects I was going to teach. This is no exaggeration. I had once passed a history exam, but God knows how. I still got confused how dates with 16 on the front could occur in the 17th century. That's about as basic as history gets. So far as geography was concerned, I had to look the word up to see what it comprised of other than looking at maps. I was less clueless about the basics of English, but I didn't realize at the time that I was assuming that English grammar was the same as the Latin grammar I had been taught so well. So well, in fact, that when a boy asked me during prep whether ager, A-G-E-R, was second or third declension, I was able to tell him without pausing for thought that A-G-E-R, ager, a field, was second declension, so it went like anus, but that it dropped the E, as opposed to aga, a rampart, which was third declension, and retained the E. My God, I thought as he walked away, Captain Lancaster did a good job. My next thought was, lucky the boy didn't ask me what a rampart was. But given that I was teaching 10-year-olds, Geoffrey Tolson's advice to stay a page ahead seemed perfectly sound. So I had no reason to believe, as I strode purposefully into the classroom to teach Form 3 their first history lesson, that I was walking into an ambush. After getting all their names down on a floor plan, I started teaching them some stuff about William the Conqueror, which I had carefully memorized the previous evening. Things were going uneventfully when a small boy with very white hair in the second row put up his hand and said, "Sir, what are the dates of Henry VIII?" I immediately countered that we were not discussing Henry VIII and that the date of the Battle of Hastings was 1066, but that I was prepared to talk to him about Henry VIII at the end of the lesson, by which time I would have had a chance to pay a quick visit to the master's common room to look up the dates in question. So, at the end of the lesson, he comes up to me and I pretend I've just noticed him, and I say very casually, 1509 to 1547. And he says, "I know, sir, but what are the dates of Charles I?" And I feel a flash of panic, and I nearly say, "That's not fair." Then I think twice about saying, "I'll tell you in a moment. First, I have to get another piece of chalk from the master's common room." In the end, I settle for, "Well, what do you think they are?" To which he replies without batting an eyelid, 1625 to 1649. And I smile inscrutably and say, the most interesting thing about Charles I is that he was a foot shorter at the end of his reign than he was at the beginning. Thinking it might get a laugh and take the pressure off, but the little bastard now tells me that he has memorised all the dates of the kings and queens of England, and he challenges me to ask him one. And I venture, Richard IV? And he blurts out, there wasn't one, thinking that I'm trying to catch him out. And then he says he knows all the capitals of all the countries in the world as well, and of course I have to teach him geography the next fucking day. I can't recall how the conversation ended, but the next thing I can remember is hiding up in my garret and cramming the dates of all the kings and queens of England, carefully excluding Anne the Second, William the Fifth, and Darren the First, and then all the world's capital cities, or hamlets. I would like to take this chance to thank the little white-haired bastard, because knowing those dates enabled me for the first time to enjoy learning about history. Before then, I never seemed to be able to get into the subject, but now I had a framework on which I could hang odd bits of information. And slowly the whole thing began to make sense in a post hoc ergo propter hoc sort of way. I'm not striking a rhetorical attitude when I say that I genuinely don't understand why the skill of memorizing, learning by rote, as its detractors always refer to it, has got itself such a bad name. True, it was overdone in the past, but that doesn't make it bad in itself. I'm grateful that one of the compensations of acting is discovering how to learn lines. I enjoy it when friends more literate than I can quote an apt passage of prose or poetry. And I enjoy it even more when I can remember a snippet myself. It can be fun to learn a short poem. I really rather care for fish. In fact, they are my favourite dish. I love the sole, I value dabs, I prize all carp, I lust for crabs. I like to take small bits of dace and put them right into my face. This didn't take me more than a couple of weeks to learn, yet I enjoy knowing it. And when I can persuade a real actor, like Kevin Kline, to do a bit of Hamlet over dinner, it can be quite thrilling. Once I had negotiated my first few days and learned all the boys' names, I was able to settle into a very comfortable routine. There had been very few changes since 1953. The Reverend Dolman had taken a parish in the Midlands, so Mr. Bartlett had resumed teaching senior classics. Competitive boxing had been abolished, much to everyone's relief, and one of Mrs. Tolson's corgis had died, also much to everyone's relief. But otherwise, things were much better than they had been when I was a schoolboy. There are great advantages to being in an institution. Everything is predictable. You know exactly what you have to do. Everything else is done for you. I woke up at 7:30. I made myself presentable before joining the school at breakfast. Then I sat in the master's common room where Mr. Bartlett was masterminding the Times crossword. Trooped last in line into assembly for prayers where all the masters were seated facing the boys, while Mr. Tolson read out some prayers and an extract from the New Testament. Stood to join the hymn, a high-pitched cacophony which, to the ears of a neutral observer, must have sounded like a deliberate attempt to annoy the Almighty. Seated myself to receive Mr. Tolson's blessing, followed by a few words about what was on his mind that particular morning, and then taught form lessons roughly resembling English history and geography before retiring to the common room half an hour before lunch to get my breath back, exchanging the morning's howlers with my colleagues and watch Mr. Bartlett continuing with the crossword. Then off to lunch when, in accordance with my status, I sat at the end of a long table of 9- and 10-year-olds. It took a little time to learn how to converse with them. I once sponsored some university research into the intelligence of cats, as I'd been irritated by my vet's derogatory assessment of one of mine. After a few months, I received back from the Sussex University professor, whose palm I had greased, cats are very intelligent at all the things that cats need to be intelligent about. which was only slightly less irksome than the original veterinary put-down. Be that as it may, a 9-year-old boy is as intelligent as he needs to be, but not more. For example, at my first meal, I asked one of the boys how old he was, and he asked me the same question. I suggested he should try and guess. 40, he ventured. This was before I grew a beard. Another time, I showed some boys the old optical illusion by which you look as though you've removed the top joint of your thumb. When they tried, some of them became rather upset that they couldn't do it. They hadn't realized it was a trick. So, provided I avoided irony, conversation flowed quite easily, even if it was a little limited. What they liked best were stories of pranks I'd played on my teachers. What they were keenest to tell me about were statistics about dinosaurs and cricket and how people were tortured to death in China. After lunch came the splendid St. Peter's custom called rest. The boys went into the big room and sat at their desk and read something they enjoyed, except for the very youngest who lay on the beds in an upstairs dormitory and were read to by Miss Lovell. The staff claimed their armchairs and smoked and dozed and finished the Times crossword. In the afternoon, there were lessons and games. I was put in charge of the youngest boy's soccer, and since I'd loved the game for as long as I could remember, it came as a complete surprise that they had absolutely no idea how it was played. I'd spaced them out at the start, explaining to each one what his position was as I placed him in it. Centre-forward, left half, right wing, goalkeeper. But the moment I blew the whistle, the boy nearest the ball kicked it as hard as he could in no particular direction, and then they all ran after the ball in a pack until one of them caught up with it, and then he kicked it, and then they all haired after it again without taking any account of the whereabouts of the goalposts. It was all so wonderfully random and mindless that I stood there crying with laughter and unable for some time to summon up the breath to blow the whistle. By the time I did, they disappeared into a field of cabbages where they continued to play, apparently quite unaware of the change in the terrain. A few blasts and some shouting brought them back to me so that I could calm them down and explain that some of them should try to kick the ball towards this goal while the others should aim at that one and that they should try and spread out a bit. They nodded, I blew the whistle, and they continued exactly as before. I blew again, same explanation, same result. They were not being disobedient. My authority was not being defied. It was just that they could not understand. So, the moment the whistle blew, instinct took over. Eventually, I just let the match continue. They were getting plenty of exercise, and we had at least achieved stage one. They were kicking the ball and not trying to eat it. Once games and afternoon lessons were over, my official duties for the day were done, so I could mark tests or prepare lessons for the next day or just play chess and snooker with the boys until they went to dinner, or teach myself some history, geography, and English. In the early evening, I would join the Tolsons for dinner in a corner of the dining hall. Mr. Bartlett was always present, as were a couple of the younger masters. I have no recollection of the kind of conversations that took place, but I think this was where I learned that the main purpose of such a social occasion was to avoid any embarrassment. Everybody was polite and well-mannered, and there were even restrained laughs on occasion, and some evenings a glass or two of Bulmer's Woodpecker cider. In 2 years I never heard a disagreement or a belch or a moment's tactlessness or a risque joke or a political or religious opinion or a rude interruption or even an embarrassing silence. A fart would have been physically impossible. On Sundays, we were all invited after dinner to the Tolsons' drawing room where we would sip coffee and listen to the radio. In retrospect, I wish I could have taken everyone to watch an evening's cage fighting. Can't imagine what they would have made of such a display of bad manners. I know a woman who was in Paris once with her father, and because the rain was so bad, they took refuge in a cinema that was showing a recently released movie called Last Tango in Paris with Marlon Brando. Her father sat through the whole film, including the infamous butter scene, and didn't speak until they emerged back into the daylight, at which point he announced, "Well, I thought that was all really rather unnecessary." I think Mr. Bartlett would have found cage fighting rather unnecessary. Now that I was an adult, or nearly one, I found the impressions that I'd formed as a child of Geoffrey Tolson and his colleagues required a certain degree of modification. Mr. Tolson, for example, still came across as the good-hearted, straightforward, decent chap I recalled from a few years before, but now I began to notice odd moments that suggested he was not the brightest lighthouse on the coastline. For instance, he once got very cross during assembly because he felt the boys had become lazy, and so he demanded that every single boy in the school should improve his ranking in class in the course of the next fortnight. It was not only the maths teachers who thought this too much of a stretch. It was just as well that his instincts for running the school were so pitch-perfect, because if he had to hold more than a certain amount of information in his head at any given time, he could easily become confused. At the end of lunchtime one Saturday, he made an announcement in the course of which he stipulated that boys who were going out with their parents that weekend should get their hair cut after they had been down to the changing room to move all their sports clothing onto the lower peg, if their peg number was between 1 and 37, to allow the visiting school teams to use the upper pegs, unless they were going out as the guest of a boy's parents that weekend, in which case they should first collect their fortnightly reports so that they could include them with their letter home, provided they were not off games, in which case they should first collect their chit from matron, but not until they'd move their clothes down to the lower peg, and then present the chit to the master on duty, and then... And here he went silent for some time, his brain, having decided to go on strike. The entire school waited with bated breath at the hope of clarification of what the hell everybody was supposed to do next. Slowly, Mr. Tolson's face took on a peaceful, if slightly sad expression, as scenes from his past life flashed before him. And then he inhaled deeply and announced impressively, "Should all get their hair cut." At which point, he sat down. A bewildered silence followed, as the entire school sat there examining their nails and pretending that they'd not noticed that the person who was in charge of the place had just gone mad. 23 years later, I had a huge fun trying to recapture this moment on paper for the start of the sex lesson in The Meaning of Life. I found I could not come up with anything better. So Mr. Tolson's real-life words became the introduction to the sex demonstration. One aspect of Mr. Tolson was that he could be charmingly old-fashioned. He was, for example, the only man I've ever met who literally put his tongue in his cheek when he made a facetious remark. He also adored great English sporting traditions like cricket. If England had done well, he would interrupt prep, beaming, to announce the scores, and he never missed attending the varsity rugby match at Twickenham. As a good Cambridge man, he was slightly crestfallen if Oxford won. When it came to the world of emotions, I suspect he would have found something rather discreditable about a man discussing his innermost feelings, except perhaps in exceptional cases with his wife. And yet he abolished the boxing competition because he was touched by the boys' complaints that they didn't like punching their friends. And on another occasion, when a boy who specialised in pushing masters over the edge so infuriated me that I pulled his hair, which shameful act he naturally reported, Mr. Tolson took me aside and told me gently about the boy's background and how he had been adopted by parents who had never ceased to remind him how lucky he had been and how much he owed them, and explained that this was why he compulsively goaded authority figures, all of which enabled me to make a proper apology and, to my delight, to develop a much better relationship with the boy. I can still remember the tone of the conversation with Mr. Tolson and my surprise at finding someone apparently so bluff and hearty also able to show such concern and understanding for a boy generally regarded as a complete pest. Despite his compassion, our headmaster did have a bit of a temper. Fortunately, though, our bystanders could always see the explosion coming, and this is because as he got angrier, he got pinker. He was already quite pink to start with his fine, bald, domed head dominant. But as his ire built, he passed through a remarkable range of shades of the colour on his way to puce, enabling an expert to calibrate accurately the right moment to depart. The reasons for his anger were never hard to discern. They always boiled down to a lack of moral fibre on the part of someone or something. Such feckless behaviour was always described as being wet. What was unusual about Mr. Tolson's temper was that he often lost it. Once wetness, in any form at all, was sighted, and the first sign of extra pinkness displayed, there was no way to abort the process. It took on a life of its own and could only be resolved with a good deal of noise. I think he literally did not know that anger could be directed into any other outcome. This led to difficulties when the explosion had to be delayed. One Saturday, our great rivals from Burnham-on-Sea, St. Dunstan's, beat all five of our teams at soccer. In the aftermath, Mr. Tolson apparently decided that this shameful thrashing was due to serial acts of cowardice by members of our team, to do with turning their backs on St. Dunstan's players who were about to kick the ball hard. This was an eccentric analysis of the reason for our defeats, which was clearly to do with the fact that St. Dunstan's were much, much better at football than we were. The staff had no wind of what was coming when the next day we assembled in the common room a few minutes before the Sunday morning prayer service was due to begin. We intuited that our headmaster would be feeling a bit snippy about the previous afternoon's debacle, but when he knocked on the door to lead us into the service, we were alarmed to note that he was a shade of pink hitherto unreported, one the other side of shocking pink, but nonetheless shocking for that. As we solemnly marched behind him into the big room to take our seats facing the congregation, I found myself wondering whether he might dispense with divine service altogether and get to his point straight away. But no, formalities had to be observed, and so prayers began. There is something quite disorienting about hearing the teaching of our Lord Jesus Christ delivered as a murderous rant. But Geoffrey Tolson was in the grip of a pink mist, which temporarily obscured from him the beauty of the gospel of love, so that his delivery of the Lord's Prayer made it sound more like an ultimatum, and the final blessing, as he tore through it at record speed, more like a war cry, as he grew nearer to the moment when, beetroot pink, he revealed the cause of his fury. And now, in the name of God, the Father, God, the Son, and God, the Holy Ghost, may all good things be with you evermore, life without end. And I want to talk about our dreadful performance, and especially St. Peter's boys turning their backs on St. Dunstan's boys as they're about to kick the ball. At last, with no noticeable transition whatsoever from the sacred to the profane, Tolson stormed away at the sheer moral turpitude of St. Peter's boys turning their backs just because someone was going to kick a big, wet, heavy football right into their private parts. Slowly he went from extra shocking pink to beetroot pink to puce to carnation to flamingo to amaranth to geranium to coral to incarnadine and then slowly back down again to normal, everyday, common or garden. And so calm was restored, and the St. Peter's boys looked suitably less moist. The only other manifestation of Tolsonian wrath was bilateral. Sometimes in the later evening, a few of us would be correcting homework or reading in the master's common room, just a few feet from the Tolson's living room, when we would hear bursts of shouting and door banging, which left us frozen in our chairs. We were all terrified at the thought of the embarrassment that we would experience if any of us bumped into one of the Tolsons immediately after they had concluded a shouting match. Since the avoidance of embarrassment had become the main purpose of our lives, and since knock-down and drag-out quarrels were major infractions of genteel middle-class values, being caught as a witness of such a fracas would be rated only slightly better than observing them accidentally copulating. I think we all shared a nasty, if unspoken, suspicion that if such a situation arose, the teacher in question would be obliged, out of a sense of honour, to shoot himself. So, for some time after the noise of battle had subsided, we would sit very still until one of us felt bold enough to creep towards the door and put his ear to it, and then, after opening it a crack, judge if the coast was clear enough for us to risk scuttling to our bedrooms. Had Mr. Tolson seen his teaching staff behaving in this truly pathetic way, he would have promptly labelled us wet and fired us anyway. But then the whole reason for our mouse-like behaviour was to avoid being spotted. I feel our discretion cancelled out our cowardice. Being caught red-eared by Mrs. Tolson would actually have been worse, as she was deadlier than the male, if not as noisy. The key to her personality was that she could be charming, but then so could Stalin, and, like her, Joe knew how to throw his weight about. In Jean Tolson's case, this was not a lot of weight physically, but what she had, she threw about very stylishly and with considerable effect. This was not a woman you wanted to get on the wrong side of. But she was charming and almost friendly most of the time, provided you played your cards right. Most noticeably of all, she was attractive. And in a town like Weston-super-Mare, she stood out like a matador at a Quaker meeting. Tall, elegant, and slim, very slim by Westonian standards. She had immaculate dark hair and a striking, almost sharp-featured face that was handsome rather than pretty. Owing to my stunted sexual development, I was not at that age able to discern whether she was sexy, though in retrospect I think she must have been. That said, anyone harbouring carnal thoughts about her would have been taking his life in his hands, because she exuded an air of designer barbed wire. But what was most intriguing of all was her slightly exotic, or perhaps just un-English, appearance. Her complexion was somewhat Portuguese. Her lipstick rather bright, and she conveyed the impression of a pent-up Latin temperament, albeit one that in Weston had to be expressed by slamming doors rather than through smoking Gauloises or flamenco or honour killings. Looking back 50-odd years later, I can now see that Mrs. T was really much too stylish and sophisticated to be married to a prep school headmaster in a backwater like Weston. I think she would much rather have been the wife of, say, the President of France, using her excellent grasp of French to entertain visiting statesmen and to host soirees of debonair Nouvelle Vague film directors and soigner enfants terribles and moody relatives of Jean-Paul Sartre instead of being forced to hobnob with a bunch of moth-eaten teachers whose conversational staple was county cricket. In a moment of unusual self-revelation, Mr. Tolson once told me that at the end of their first year running St. Peter's, he and his wife had gone up to London, planning to spend a few weeks there taking in some shows, generally enjoying nights out on the town. However, after viewing the bill at the end of the first week, they were forced to beat a retreat back to Weston-super-Mare with their tails between their legs. I was rather touched that he confided this in me and felt a little sad that the lifestyle bubble that they might have imagined for themselves had been burst in this way, but I couldn't help feeling that Mrs. Tolson must have been the more disillusioned. All things considered, I think Jean Tolson accepted the diminution of her hopes with considerable grace, and that the easy condescension with which she treated the teaching staff was not only understandable, but indeed justified. The only member of staff immune from her de haut en bas attitude was Geoffrey Bartlett. He was too obviously an Edwardian gentleman and a scholar to be treated as just another dowdy non-entity, and if not exactly an equal, he would certainly have found a place in the same lifeboat. When I met him again on rejoining St. Peter's as a teacher, I was rather apprehensive, as I was still a little in awe of him, and I knew that he'd not really liked me as a boy. Not that he'd ever been unkind, but there was something about the young Cleese that he clearly found slightly distasteful, and incipient crassness, perhaps, that his refined, indeed fastidious nature could not warm to. But now he greeted me with a courtesy that approached warmth. The boys told me that their punning nickname for me, Themistocles, came from him, and we settled into a surprisingly comfortable relationship based on my real respect for him. I began to notice he was somewhat quieter than I'd remembered, but it was hard to tell whether it was shyness or his cultivated Edwardian gentlemanly manner, for he took moderation and restraint to extremes. To have done anything with gusto would have been inconceivable to him. When he bowled in the practice cricket nets, he did so in his sports jacket and without removing his pipe from his mouth. He was the epitome of the Oxonian code of effortless superiority, whereby to be seen trying really hard to achieve something was in many ways worse than actually failing at it. I'm sure that many of us boys who had been in such awe of him mimicked his attitude, not least because it came across as a distinct moral requirement rather than just a matter of temperament. If we had hero-worshipped Mr. Tolson instead, we would have left St. Peter's believing the most important thing in life was to try jolly hard to do one's best. Bartlett's air of effortless superiority imprinted itself so strongly upon me because it chimed in with what I'd absorbed from my father's stories of the upper class's way of behaving, some aspects of which seemed, and still seem to me, to be admirable. Genuinely good manners are, after all, essentially a way of moderating one's own egotism, often in the service of considering the egos of others. Even if it's done mainly for show, it's still a start. It would have been unimaginable for Bartlett or me to have suggested a meal together, not improper, just beyond the bounds of possibility. But sometimes, when we were in the common room alone, he would tell me a little about himself. He'd obviously been considered very promising as a boy at Uppingham, and when he left for Oxford to read classics, I think he felt he might become a real scholar. But he had an experience at the hand of R.G. Collingwood, the famous philosopher and historian, from which he never recovered. Collingwood's obituary in the Times just a few years later pronounced him one of the six finest minds in Europe. So Bartlett was thrilled to discover on his first day at Oxford that Collingwood was to be one of his tutors. He was assigned some reading before their first meeting, and studying as he never had before, he prepared what he thought was a really insightful and original question, which he posed to Collingwood as soon as they'd made their introductions. Without pausing, Collingwood told him that if he, Bartlett, would care to go to the bookcase behind him, he did not bother to look round, and from the second shelf up, take the sixth book from the left, the one with the red cover, and then turn to page 134. The fourth paragraph would answer Bartlett's question better than Collingwood could ever hope to himself. Poor Bartlett got up and found the book so described, and there in the fourth paragraph of page 134 was a perfect, complete answer to his question. At which point he sadly thought to himself, what is the point? Why devote one's life to something like philosophy when there are people as outrageously brilliant as Collingwood, with whom one could never hope to compete? Not that Bartlett was ever expecting to get so far as the quarter-finals of the All England Metaphysics Championship, but if one can't participate on roughly equal terms with the best, why bother? And at that moment, as far as I could tell, a shadow fell across Bartlett's life, which never entirely faded. Then he told me another Collingwood story that was even more alarming. Bartlett had spent his entire life in one of the posher parts of Cheshire, and he knew the terrain like the back of his hand, as they used to say, but don't anymore. He discovered that Collingwood had once spent a holiday there, and during a short spell in hospital, when he had nothing better to do, had written a small guidebook to the area from memory. So Bartlett ran out and bought a copy and went through it with a fine-tooth comb, as it were, until he found a mistake. Collingwood had described a stile by a country lane which Bartlett had walked along all his life, a style which he knew did not exist. Triumphantly, he raced guidebook in hand from his house until he came to the spot where the alleged style was supposed to have been. And there it was. With the extinguishment of his ray of hope that Collingwood had finally made a mistake, Bartlett turned, trudged home, and shot himself. Metaphorically, of course. I suppose one could argue, though, that Collingwood had made a mistake, if a good tutor's job is to nurture pupils intellectually, to stimulate their curiosity, and above all, to encourage their love of learning. The Wainfleet Professor of Metaphysical Philosophy rather blew it, didn't he? Instead of engaging Bartlett and drawing out his abilities, the professor pulled what might be described as a cheap music hall Mr. Memory Man trick, which instead had the effect of discouraging his student for good. One might have hoped that Collingwood's love of wisdom would have discouraged such a faux casual showing off, but great intellects, ironically, are often allied to stunted emotional development. When Bartlett left Oxford, his academic hopes unfulfilled, he decided, like many of his friends, that war with Germany was coming. So he took a job teaching classics at St. Peter's as a temporary measure. Not long afterwards, he joined the army as an artillery officer, was made a major, and commanded a battery of guns during the Allied advance up Italy. What he was very proud of was not his bravery — to have been proud of that would have smacked of self-advertisement — but that the final position of his guns after several months' advance was less than 15 yards from the position that he calculated on his map using his trigonometry skills. At the end of the war, he returned to St. Peter's to find that his position as senior classics master had been filled by the Reverend A.H. Dolman. This did not surprise him. He expected Tolson to find a replacement. What rather irked him was that Dolman was a German. Since Bartlett was quite practised at killing them, I think he was tempted to add just one more to an already impressive total. Who would notice? But his good manners got the better of him, inevitably, so he took over the teaching of mathematics instead. Many years later, when Python was performing the stage show in Liverpool, I lunched with Mr. Bartlett. He was, of course, retired by then. He told me that he'd left St. Peter's after a disagreement with Mr. Tolson, and had spent short periods at a couple of other schools before giving up teaching. There was an air about him that suggested disappointment, that he felt he had not been fairly treated. At the end of the meal, I plucked up the courage to ask about the disagreement, and he told me that he had discovered, inadvertently, that Mr. Tolson had been paying him, as senior classics and mathematics master, less than Mr. Jones, the school odd job man. In retrospect, it seems strange that, despite the general air of affability, the St. Peter's staff seldom socialised, except when sometimes, after the evening meal with the Tolsons, two or three of us would wander down to the saloon bar at one of the local pubs, where I slowly worked my way through the brightly coloured bottles containing international liqueurs. My usual sipping companion was a chap who taught history named Anthony Viney, whose life, by his own description, abounded with a certain kind of comedy scene where a well-meaning innocent accidentally creates chaos and destruction. For example, when Tony took on a Christmas job as a postman, He was given an enormous, extravagantly wrapped box of goodies to deliver to a particular house. As he struggled to carry the huge crate up the drive, the children inside saw him coming and raced out to greet him, jumping up and down in excitement and thronging round him. So much so that as he reached the doorstep, he failed to see several milk bottles there and tripped, breaking a couple, losing his balance, and in the process dropping the box on the head of the smallest child and treading on the family dog. The screaming and yelping brought the parents to the door, and they proved understandably angered by this gratuitous assault on their family life. Tony picked himself up, apologized, attempted to comfort the damaged child, and suddenly realized that he brought the magnificent Christmas offering to the wrong address. Embarrassed beyond endurance, he tried to stammer out an apology, but the father was now shouting so loudly that Tony gave up, grabbed the crate, and ran back down the drive as the children sobbed and howled at this sudden and incomprehensible turn of events. What I found so funny about this tale was the enormous gap between Tony's intention and the outcome. To start with, the story would immediately cease to be funny if Tony had caused any of this chaos on purpose. Similarly, in Forty Towers, Manuel regularly wrecks Basil's plans out of a fervent desire to help him. Again, if there was any intent to hinder, the joke wouldn't work. Next, Tony was a particularly kind and considerate man, and to have inflicted the emotional distress that he did on this unsuspecting family was agonizing for him. The story is, in my view, funnier for this awareness on his part than it would be if he hadn't realized what he'd done, or if he had realized but simply hadn't cared. In the case of Tony the Postman, we can see the whole picture, the purity of his motives, the inconsequentiality of broken milk bottles, the fact that the hijacked goodies were not intended for the family anyway, and above all, that the emotions suffered by the family and the dog were ultimately transient and so harmless. When James Thurber described humour as emotional chaos remembered in tranquility, he was only pointing out that things that seem very important at the time usually aren't, and that it's not unkind to laugh at temporary upsets, especially when they're not your own. In fact, it's rightly considered healthy to be able to laugh at oneself, and we all much prefer people who do not take themselves too seriously. A good sense of humour is a sign of a healthy perspective, which is why people who are uncomfortable around humour are either pompous, inflated, or neurotic, oversensitive. Pompous people mistrust humour because at some level they know that their self-importance cannot survive very long in a humorous atmosphere, so they criticise humour as negative or subversive. Neurotics, sensing that humour is always ultimately critical, view it therefore as unkind and destructive, a reductio ad absurdum which leads to political correctness. Not that laughter can't be unkind and destructive. Like most manifestations of human behaviour, it ranges from the loving to the hateful. The latter produces nasty racial jokes and savage teasing. The former produces warm and affectionate banter and the kind of inclusive humour that says, isn't the human condition absurd, but we're all in the same boat. Which brings me to another story that Tony Viney told me, which is very cruel and quite hilarious, I hope. Once upon a time, a very kind and gentle history teacher called Tony was driving home at the end of a summer bank holiday. The traffic was even worse than he'd feared, and by the time he reached Salisbury Plain, the cars were bumper to bumper and moving forward at a rate of about one car's length every other Thursday. Tony was very hot, as well as bored and sleepy, when all of a sudden he saw a rabbit, and it was not a happy bunny. It was, in fact, a sad and miserable little bunny, because it was in the last stages of myxomatosis. This was in the 50s, when the virus was devastating Britain's rabbit population. And it lay there, hardly breathing, its face disfigured by swelling, its eyes so puffed up it was no longer able to see, sores and tumours clearly visible all over its body, and with just hours, if not minutes, to live. And Tony, being a kind and gentle man and an ardent animal lover to boot, was appalled to see such awful suffering, and his heart went out to the pitiable animal. And he left his car and he crossed a few yards of grass until he stood by the dying creature, and seeing its nasal discharge and its swollen ears and its strangely enlarged genitals, he choked back his tears, swallowed, and vowed that very moment to put the poor, dear thing out of its misery. He reached down and picked it up by its ears, held it well away from himself, took a deep breath, and karate chopped the back of its neck, giving it the deadly rabbit punch which he had read about somewhere. Unfortunately, however, the poor creature had not read the same piece, and so the blow caused it to spring to life and to start leaping about, inasmuch as a rabbit can leap about when it's been held up by its ears, with a suddenness that scared its would-be assassin out of his wits. In the normal course of events, Tony would now have dropped the rabbit and run for his life. But his determination to do the right thing by the rabbit was so great that his nerve held, and realizing that the first karate chop had failed simply because he had not struck the dying creature firmly enough, out of kindness, he held it up again, grasped its ears even more tightly, and let fly at it once more. Alas, in his haste to do God's work, he had neglected to take aim properly, and so he caught the rabbit, which was, to be fair, now a moving target, with a glancing blow on the side of its head, thus spurring it to further exertions, while at the same time releasing a surprising quantity of nasal discharge onto his suit. However, the latter event was a matter of very little importance to Tony at this juncture. The question of how to terminate this remarkably resilient rabbit was now occupying his mind so totally that feelings of shame and inadequacy and self-hatred could hardly be sensed through his all-consuming panic. How, in God's name, was he going to kill it? Various options flashed through his mind: shooting, hanging, drowning, electrocution, impalement, crucifixion, a guillotine, something sharp, a knife, a saw, a dagger, an axe, a penknife. I've got one in the car. I'll cut its throat. Perfect. He turned towards the car and froze. Up to this moment, Tony had been so focused on the poor rabbit that he'd completely failed to notice the crescendoing sound of car horns and angry shouting that now suddenly enveloped him. As far as the eye could see, and Salisbury Plain is famous for its flatness, motorists and their passengers, all still stuck in the traffic jam, were shouting and shaking their fists and cursing him and screaming threats. A number were opening their car doors and getting out. For a few seconds, Tony was astonished. Could all these people really believe that he was beating up this rabbit for fun? That he'd left his car and pounced on the poor unsuspecting bunny as a form of blood sport? And that he then started using the thing as a punch bag just to pass the time till the traffic started moving again? That he, kind and gentle Tony, was in fact a sadistic, vile, murderous brute destined for the front page of the Daily Mail? Well, I'm afraid that's exactly what they thought. Unfair, wasn't it? So, what was Tony to do in the light of this latest development? Plan A, which was to take the rabbit back to the car, where he could quietly stab it to death with his Swiss Army knife, seemed too lengthy a procedure, given that people were now actually heading in his direction. He needed something a bit quicker. To his credit, he never even considered following his natural inclination, which was to throw the rabbit away and run. The creature had suffered enough already. He could not let it down. To be dying of myxomatosis and then, in the middle of that, to be attacked so gratuitously. And after that, to be abandoned to myxomatosis again was a fate no one deserved. So plan B was... Wait a moment, thought Tony. If it's called a rabbit punch, since rabbits can't punch, it must actually kill rabbits, eventually. So, if at first you don't succeed... And he started hitting it again with greater determination. The approaching mob stopped in astonishment. Was he deliberately baiting them? A howl of fury arose from them that froze Tony's blood, and they moved forward again. And now he panicked. He threw the rabbit on the ground and jumped up and down on it. Then he checked it was dead, shrugged, and waited to be lynched. And at this moment, God intervened. He caused the traffic to begin to move. And the mob, hearing engines starting up behind them, paused. They were faced with a stark choice. Either they could exterminate this fiend from the face of the planet, or they could regain their place in the queue. A moment of indecision, and then good sense prevailed. They hurried back to their cars, still shouting curses over their shoulders, jumped inside, and drove off in a huff. Tony pretended to faint and fell into a position where he could keep his eye on the traffic. He lay there motionless until all the cars that had been in sight during the murder had passed on, at which point he pretended to wake up and then casually strolled back to his car, got in, and fainted for real. And it was not as though this kind of thing happened to Tony now and again. Such occurrences were a regular part of his day. It was as though God's Department of Practical Jokes had singled him out for special attention along with Job. I should have become his Boswell. When I look back at my 2 years teaching at St. Peter's, the phrase halcyon days pops into my mind, and the Oxford English Dictionary tells me it refers to a past time regarded as idyllically happy and peaceful. Why was it so happy? Well, for a start, it was so free of stress. There were no public appearances, very few deadlines of any importance. A contented and relaxed atmosphere, congenial colleagues, plenty of fresh air and exercise, and I really enjoyed teaching. Of course, it was in ideal circumstances. The classes were small, maybe 15 boys. The 10-year-olds were well-mannered and cheerful and respectful and unarmed, and by and large, they wanted to learn. Discipline was no problem once you gained the ascendancy, provided only that you were fair. The boys were very keen on fairness. I won a lot of brownie points once when I wrote the non-word Woolly, W-O-O-L-Y, on the blackboard. They remonstrated with me and pointed that, but when they misspelled a word, they had to write it out several times. So I took the chalk and wrote Woolly, W-O-O-L-Y, 100 times all over the board. They approved. Honour was satisfied, and I never spelled Woolly wrong again. And maybe it gave me an idea for Life of Brian. Best of all, I discovered that when I walked out of a class at the end of a lesson, leaving behind some 10-year-olds who could now tell the difference between an adjectival and an adverbial phrase, a distinction that had been beyond them 40 minutes earlier, I experienced an inexplicable satisfaction. Partly, perhaps, because I could now tell the difference, too. My job, after all, allowed me to fill in some of the many gaps in my education left by the Clifton Science curriculum. However, during the 2 years, there were a couple of occasions when something happened that I found quite disturbing. The first time, I was teaching Form 3 about Africa. We were looking at our atlases, and I was pointing out the big countries and giving them snippets of information. Then we moved on to the big rivers, and found the Nile and the Zambezi and the Niger and the Congo. Except that one boy I'll call Smith couldn't find the last two. I told him that he would find the Niger in Nigeria and the Congo in the Belgian Congo. This was, of course, in the 50s. He looked very confused, so I gave the class something to occupy them, sat down next to Smith, and asked him what the problem was. "I can't find them, sir." "Okay, let's look for the Niger. It runs through Nigeria. Do you remember where Nigeria is?" And Smith suddenly gave a big smile and pointed to Nigeria. "Good. Now, can you see where the river Niger is marked?" Oh, yes, sir. Good. So the Congo River flows through the Belgian Congo. Where's the Belgian Congo? Yes, sir. Good. Now, can you see the blue line? That's the River Congo. Okay. Yes, sir. Now it began. Well done. So, where's the River Congo? And Smith pointed to Nigeria. I shook my head. No, Smith, it's there in the Belgian Congo. See? Smith looked puzzled again as I'd asked him to do the square root of 567,917 in his head. I pointed to the Belgian Congo and waited for his agreement, but Smith was still uneasy. I waited. I wasn't going to rush him because then he would be anxious, and when little boys get anxious, they cannot take in anything at all. So I smiled. I nodded encouragingly. After a time, I thought I should offer a little more help. So the River Congo is in the Belgian Congo, isn't it? Smith wasn't convinced. Well, they both got the word Congo, haven't they? Smith was cudgelling his brains, but there was still something not quite right about this. See, I said, River Congo, Belgian Congo. Hmm? What was I getting wrong? Was I not being clear enough? Had I not articulated properly? So very slowly, River Congo, Belgian Congo. You see, they both have Congo in them. But no, the penny wouldn't drop. Smith gave me a brave smile. He was game to go on. Smith, I said, let's start again. We're talking about two different rivers in two different countries in Africa. One river is called the Niger, and it flows through the country called Nigeria. Nigeria. Hmm? Now we move on to the second of the two rivers, which is not called Niger, but instead is called the Congo. And the river called the River Congo is found in the Belgian Congo. Now, which river, the Congo or the Niger, is found in Nigeria? Smith looked at me and made the I am really thinking this one out face, which involves screwing up your eyes and puckering the mouth and staring intently about a foot above the teacher's head, and which means you don't even know what the question means. My heart sank. Smith, I said, I promise you this is not a trick question. The Congo, he announced. At this moment, I was paralyzed by the realization that I was never, never going to find a way of transferring this piece of information from my mind into his. I would have been more gainfully employed explaining the concept of antimatter to a hamster. Never before had I comprehended that however obvious a thought may be, to understand that always requires a tiny little jump of the intellect, a minute hop that connects one thing to another, and that there exist humans who cannot achieve this transit, no matter how microscopically small it is made for them. To get a joke requires a similar mental skip, and the tricky part of constructing one is judging the width of the jump needed for the joke to be got. If you spoon-feed an intelligent audience and make the joke too obvious, they will not find it funny. But the opposite danger is to make the jump too long, and so the connection is not made, and they don't laugh at all. So anyway, there was one other puzzling experience also involving a geography class. To make the lessons fun, all the boys were expected to have their atlases open in front of them when I entered the classroom, and I would shout, China or Poland, and they had to point it out, and I would run round the class pretending to rough them up if they had the finger on the wrong country, and they would laugh and shriek and giggle, and a good time was had by all for about 5 minutes, during which they learned some basic geography. At the end of term, I gave them an outline map of the world with the frontiers of the countries marked on it, but no names. And then I gave them a list of 30 countries, and they had to write the countries' names on the map in the right places. 10 were easy, like Australia and China, 10 harder, like Switzerland and Chile, and 10 difficult, like Laos and Bolivia. At the beginning of one term, a new boy joined us. He was a little introverted, so out of fellow feeling, I let him settle in very gently. He became quite comfortable in class and seemed rather thoughtful. At the end of term, he took the world map outline test, and I was surprised and pleased to find that he'd written the name Bolivia in exactly the right place. However, that was the only one he'd got correct. He'd marked the continent of Australia as France, Sweden and Norway as Brazil, and he placed the British Isles right in the middle of the South Pacific. I was drawn inexorably to the saddening conclusion that Bolivia was almost certainly a fluke. But what perplexed me was this. What had been going on between his ears during the 20-odd lessons when the rest of the form had been learning basic world geography? He had looked passably interested. He'd manifested no anxiety. He'd never asked for help, even though I encouraged it and always praised boys when they did. So, if he felt he did not need help, what did he think he was trying to accomplish? For what purpose did he imagine he was sitting there? To practice circulating his blood? I should have asked him, because it was keeping me awake at night. And at last I found consolation in the thought that he had succeeded in writing the names of the 30 countries on the right planet. And I pinned up the exam paper on the notice board in the master's common room, along with the comment, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." When Mr. Bartlett saw it, he stared for some time and then with real feeling remarked, "The sad thing about true stupidity is that you can do absolutely nothing about it."